Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello, and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Wednesday, July 27th. I'm Anne Gordon, in for Amanda Borchel-Dunn, here today with editor David Horovitz and Religion and Diaspora Affairs correspondent Judah Ari Gross. Hello to you both.
Hi, Anne.
Hey, Anne.
We have a lot to talk about today, beginning with some challenges on the Israeli home front. We'll get a sense of the local economic picture, including some particulars of the gaps between the haves and the have-nots. We'll hear about the Histadrut, Israel's national trade union, and how they're pushing for Israelis to boycott the local food monopolies. We'll also give some attention to the ongoing question of the Jewish agency's presence in Russia. This story has the makings of quite a saga, but there have been serious efforts to keep it calm. And we'll hear a brief update on the Western Wall Mechitza issue, the egalitarian plaza there. We'll turn to you first, Judah. Tell us, what does it mean that Russia wants to close the doors of the Jewish agency there?
So tomorrow, as we record on Thursday, July 28th, there will be the first hearing of the Russian Justice Ministry's case against the Jewish agency in Russia. About a month ago, Russian authorities informed the Jewish agency that they were falling afoul, or so they claimed, of Russian laws, specifically how the Jewish agency was storing information about Russian citizens who were looking to immigrate to Israel or make aliyah. This sort of went forward last week when Russian authorities officially filed an appeal to a district court there to shutter the Jewish agency's offices in Russia. And the first hearing, as I said, will be held tomorrow. The Jewish agency in Russia and the Jewish agency around the world is sort of this quasi, not exactly, but kind of government body that facilitates and encourages immigration to Israel. It has a significant resonance in Russia due to the fact that throughout the Cold War, throughout this time of the Soviet Union, Russian Jews were not able to immigrate to Israel, were not really able to freely practice their religion. And so the fact that these steps are being taken against the Jewish agency is sort of evoking that memory and raising a lot of concerns about the future of the Russian Jewish community in general, which for the past 20, 30 years has had a real renaissance and really rebuilt itself following the fall of the Soviet Union. It started, you know, a month ago or so when the Jewish agency in Russia first got this letter. The Jewish agency tried to sort of keep it in proportion to deal with it itself. And then within the past week or two, it's become clear that this is not something that's going to be resolved so easily. And they've brought in the Israeli government, which has sort of raised this issue to a much more, clearly diplomatic rift between Israel and Russia. Prime Minister Yair Lapid has made it very clear that this would have, you know, that shuttering the Jewish agency would have a negative effect on Israeli-Russian ties. Russia has tried to maintain that this isn't a diplomatic incident, that this is just a legal issue. No one in Israel particularly believes that. The significance of this is probably not going to be a complete, you know, halting of all Russian Jewish immigration to Israel, but it would significantly complicate the situation there for Russian Jews or Russians who are eligible to immigrate to Israel. The reasons behind Russia's decision to do this are sort of myriad, from just sort of meddling Israeli domestic policy, because they don't particularly like Yair Lapid and would prefer to see someone like former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu come back into power. And so this is a way to sort of stir the pot in Israel. There's also, you know, Russia is not hugely thrilled with Israel's support for Ukraine in light of its invasion of the country earlier this year. Russia also perennially sort of takes issue with Israel's ongoing aerial campaign against Iran in Syria, because Syria is a pretty closely aligned Russian ally. And there's also a sort of very local real estate issue of Russia wanting to get control of an area of the Old City referred to as the Alexander Court, that Israel has sort of sometimes indicated it's willing to hand over to Russian control and sometimes fought handing it over to Russian control. And Russia has sort of made it very clear that they do want control over this area that that's important to the Russian church. So all of those different things, as well as Russia's sort of general opposition to civil society, which goes beyond, you know, any specific Israel issues. And then also Russia and Russian officials have a history of anti-Semitism. So the fact that this is a Jewish organization and the Jewish agency, you know, is not necessarily insignificant either.
There are some important reactions by some local, now local Israelis who are formerly Russian, right? You wrote about that.
Yeah, for people like Natan Sharansky, who was a former sort of prisoner of Zion, who was this sort of Zionist figure who was imprisoned for his political activism on that front under the Soviet Union, you know, who then went on to be chairman of the Jewish Agency, you know, obviously this is a hugely significant incident for him, and it obviously brings up a lot of those memories and a lot of the, you know, official Soviet opposition to Zionism and Israel and Jews. And I also speaking to sort of more contemporary figures like Ksenia Svetlova, who's a journalist, analyst, former parliamentarian in Israel, who was born in Moscow. You know, this is something that in and of itself, you know, is something that is an issue, but it's something that's sort of surmountable. But it's more a sign, you know, a potential sign of the times for what it means to be a Jew in Russia going forward and what it means to be a Zionist in Russia going forward. So yeah, the concern is not necessarily that, you know, only about the ramifications of this move against the Jewish Agency, but what it means for other Jewish organizations that are operating in Russia, that the Jewish Agency is a, you know, even though it's registered as a Russian organization, it gets most of its funding from abroad. And so that this allows Russia to designate something as a, you know, a foreign agent, which sort of can significantly limit its ability to operate in Russia. So the fact that there are some other Jewish organizations operating in Russia with the same sort of funding framework, you know, potentially leaves them open to similar steps by the Russian government in the future. So this is something that everyone's watching. I mean, one of the main things will be if this is something that's an open and shut case, that tomorrow at this first hearing, the Russian court says, you know, shut it down and that's it. Or if this is something that's going to be dragged out.
There's some issue with Israelis going to represent the Jewish Agency in the case. They haven't been given visas.
The claim that the Russian government is making is that this is just a legal issue. And so even though the Israeli government does not particularly believe that to be the case, they believe that this is part of a diplomatic rift that's happening. But in order to sort of play the game, the prime minister's office was planning to send a delegation of Israeli legal experts to Russia to sort of fight on behalf of the Jewish Agency. And the Russian government has stymied those efforts by refusing to issue the visas necessary. So the delegation, as far as I know, has yet to leave the country. And as I said, the hearing is going to be tomorrow.
Wow. David, can you weigh in on what you think the implications might be from these developments on Israel and Russia?
Well, it's a big deal because it does evoke the Cold War memories and the struggle for Soviet Jewry. It underlines the problematics for Israel of dealing with Putin. Israel has tried to steer this non-existent middle ground on Ukraine-Russia, where the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was careful not to condemn the Russian invasion, and the foreign minister of the time, Lapid, was adamant that it was illegitimate and was very outspoken on it, but he's now become the prime minister. So, you know, Judah referred briefly to the notion that this could be a little bit of interference in domestic political affairs by Putin, which, you know, you'd like to think sounds absurd, but possibly doesn't. Emigration from Russia, I assume, was already a little complicated because, ironically, of American sanctions on Russia, right? I assume it's been harder for Russian Jews to come out with assets in a way that would not have been an issue until the invasion. And of course, again, as Judah mentioned, there's a very direct issue for Israel of its need for Russian indulgence as it seeks to prevent Iran deepening its hold in Syria. So it's a very, very complicated situation. And it's becoming a political issue in Israel. Yesterday, Netanyahu spoke out very critically about Lapid and Gantz's ostensible mishandling of this. Other people, including Sharansky, saying, you know, Lapid has handled this the way it needs to be handled, and Israel should not be showing weakness or presenting itself as some kind of vassal state of Putin's Russia. But it's a very resonant issue, the largest reservoir of immigration for Israel over recent decades has been, certainly was when Jews were finally allowed out around 89, 1991, you know, huge aliyah from Russia. But that reservoir, you know, was not empty, and therefore there's concern.
There is indeed. We'll be keeping our eyes on this for sure. Judah, update us also on the Western Wall drama.
Let's just say the Western Wall drama that the Times of Israel has reported responsibly, and it's just staggering to me before Judah takes us into the latest twist, the degree to which this is very important to world Jewry and seems to be of no consequence whatsoever to most of the Hebrew media. I mean, the fracas, if that's a word for it, at the bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and the ongoing argument about egalitarian prayer, just not an issue in Hebrew media.
Can I disagree with you a little bit?
You certainly can. That's my sense.
I want to just add a small caveat to what David said. I think to the mainstream Israeli press, this is of absolute no interest or value. To the Haredi and to a certain extent the national religious media, this is an area of focus. This sort of thing is getting covered in some of the national religious sort of Orthodox, modern Orthodox, and ultra Orthodox press.
And in what tone, Judah? Like in terms of what an outrage that the Reformium and the Conservativium are praying at the Kotel with men and women together? Or is there any introspection about maybe it's not the best thing to do to rip up Sidurim?
Yeah, there is some. I think the main line would be these are the steps that this left wing government is taking to support the reforming, the reform Jews, the conservative Jews. And then there is also a certain line encouraging reforming conservative prayer will sort of push people more and more to the Orthodox way of thinking about things, which is a little bit problematic if you're in favor of reforming conservative Judaism. But sort of there is that line that exists, which is a bit more pluralistic.
So what's the mechitza ban, the new mechitza ban? What is this?
So last month, you know, as listeners to the podcast may recall, a group of a few dozen ultra-Orthodox and national religious youths overran a number of American bar and bat mitzvahs ceremonies that were being held at the egalitarian section of the Western Wall, an area that's called Ezrat Yisrael. It's called a few different things. It's also called Robinson's Arch. Prime Minister Yair Lapid denounced what happened. Diaspora Affairs Minister Nachman Shai denounced what happened, as well as a few other ministers and Knesset members. And Yair Lapid had sort of promised to take certain steps. He said he would address the issue to try to ensure that, you know, Jews of all streams could pray safely at the Western Wall. Nothing really happened in terms of ensuring that police would prevent, you know, groups of people from overrunning and disrupting egalitarian prayer at the Western Wall. But what did happen yesterday was the Prime Minister's office issued a new directive that would prevent a mechitza or a sort of gender separating barrier from being brought into the egalitarian section of the Western Wall. And that's something that didn't happen, you know, it specifically did not happen at these bar and bat mitzvah ceremonies, but it has happened in the past where Orthodox activists have brought in these barriers and set them up as a way of sort of taking over the site and turning what is an egalitarian prayer space into a non-egalitarian prayer space. And so this new ban will give police the ability to stop people from doing that. In the past, there has been claims that police can't really, you know, stop somebody or arrest them for doing that because it's not overtly, you know, against the rules or against the law. It's supposed to be some kind of a symbolic step toward ensuring the nature of the egalitarian section of the Western Wall.
Wow. Okay. Thanks, Judah. We're going to keep an eye on that. I know that Rosh Chodesh is coming up, and I'm hoping that won't be too dramatic as we talk about these Western Wall dramas. It's time for a break. On our return, David will talk about the general state of things, including when it comes to Israel's food monopolies.
Yo, You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now. And you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza. Genocide perpetrated by Hamas. No, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its sixth season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy!
And we're back. So, David, fill us in on what's happening with these food monopolies.
Well, look, Israel is laboring under an increasingly heavy cost of living burden. Everything from basic foodstuffs all the way across to housing. We've talked a lot on the podcast about skyrocketing housing prices. The rental market has been soaring, especially lately. And now a lot of attention has begun to focus on food. Manufacturers and suppliers have been raising prices, threatening to raise prices. There's been an argument about basic foodstuffs like bread, where some kind of compromise proposal has been agreed with suppliers and with manufacturers. They were planning a 10% hike. They're going to have a 5% hike in the short term. But what we've had this week is the leader of the Histadrut, the association, I suppose, of trade unions, the Federation of Trade Unions, encouraging Israelis to boycott major food monopolies. He cited about three of them. Their names are not known to most Israelis because their name is not what's stamped on the products. But these are the people who bring in supply, oversee vast ranges of products. It's a very atypical statement for him to have made, and it reflects growing concern about prices. And his point was that the hikes are illegitimate, that the monopolies are claiming that all their raw materials have gone up, that the world is laboring under an inflationary burden, that prices are rising, and they have no alternative but to transfer these hikes onto the consumer. And the Histadrut leader, and indeed quite a lot of reporting, suggests that this is not entirely credible, to put it mildly, and certainly that these monopolies, by their very nature, because they're monopolies and the public has not been protected from them effectively, they're doing just great. They're making colossal amounts of money. They're paying themselves vast amounts of money. They're issuing dividends to shareholders, which in some cases are the public, because the public does have shares via pension schemes and so on. But the bottom line is the trade union leader is saying we're being ripped off, inequalities are growing, and we need to stop this.
I know we'll all be glad if those food prices come down. What about those teachers? How is the school year going to start with a deficit of teachers?
Well, you know, it's the same theme in that, and, you know, I'm going to be sort of anecdotal and big picture-y here. You see Israel that's being pulled forward, thank goodness, by a thriving tech economy where not everything is perfect. There have been layoffs in the tech industry as well, but where investment overseas is in the tech industry is still colossal, where Israel's tech industry is central to a thriving export sector, where people in tech are doing fairly well financially, are earning relatively well financially, and lots of the rest of the populace and the economy are being left behind. And this is being felt everywhere. It's being felt in the medical profession where, you know, nurses are radically underpaid. And it's being felt in the education sector where teachers and everyone in that system are radically underpaid. And again, anecdotally, what I know from, you know, young people who are in my kids' peer group, anyone who has any potential capacity to find a job in the tech industry looks across and sees that if they did that rather than whatever they're doing now, they'll earn double and triple what they're earning now. And without that, they can't afford to rent somewhere to live. So it's, you know, it's incredibly acute and very, very personal. And we're feeling it in the teaching profession right now, where the statistic is indeed something like 6,000 teachers, that they are short for the reopening of the school year in just a few weeks. Why would you go into teaching to earn, in Israeli terms, the argument that the unions are having with the Treasury, we're around the 9,500 shekel figure, which is considerably less than $3,000 a month. Why would you do that and teach your overlarge class and your loud and unruly children when you can be, I don't know, a receptionist at a major tech company and earn double? And a lot of people who wanted to be teachers and who were teachers in many cases are starting to think about moving across or are moving across. And, you know, it's the widening of inequality in Israel. It's not an Israeli limited issue, but we're feeling it pretty acutely at the moment.
If I can just sort of carry that forward, some of the long-term concerns in this as well is that if you don't have enough teachers and you don't have good teachers because all of the good qualified people are moving into the tech sector, then years down the line, you're not going to have the well-educated populace that you need in order to continue having tech workers, 10, 20 years in the future, which is why this is something that's, short-term good for maybe individual people, but long-term source of concern for the tech sector in general, that you're not going to have the educated population that you need to continue this.
It's a real problem. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. Thank you, David. Thank you, Judah. Until next time.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.